And now one of the highlights of Sunday television becomes a monitor feature presentation, Youth Wants to Know. Earlier today, teenagers from the Washington, D.C. area met to question Democratic Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Senator Humphrey has just returned from a trip to the Middle East, where he met personally with Egyptian President Nasser. The senator is a member of the Foreign Relations and Agriculture Committees and the Senate Committee on Government Operations. The monitor was there in our NBC Washington studios, and we recorded every word so that we might bring you this program just as it took place this afternoon. Here now is the moderator of today's program, Steve McCormick.
Our guest today has just returned from a fact-finding mission to the Mideast and Southern Europe, where he personally conferred with leaders of state in those areas. As an authority on American foreign policy, his trip will undoubtedly have a profound influence on future programs. He's one of the outstanding spokesmen in Congress, vice presidential candidate in 56, one of the youngest Democratic members of the Senate, Hubert H. Humphrey. It's a pleasure, Senator, to have you with us on Youth Wants to Know.
Steve, it's a pleasure to be with you and all these wonderful young people on this magnificent program. I really like Youth Wants to Know. That is, until you start to work me over. Up until then, I like it.
Well, these young people who appear here, Senator, under the auspices of the National Education Association, have many questions for you, and I think we'll begin with Melissa McClendon.
Senator Humphrey, do you feel that Britain's recent move to send goods to Red China will have a permanent damaging effect on the already strained relationship between the United States and Great Britain?
No, I do not. I really think that this will be one of those other adjustments that we have to make. I can understand the British point of view. Britain is like a man that's had some trouble. He has to eat, too. And the British are a little worried about the loss of markets. They are worried about the fact that their dollar balances are running low, that is, their cash reserves, their gold balances. And Britain also sees in China the Japanese moving into that market. She sees the Germans moving into the market, the Dutch and others, and so she wants to get some market of her own.
That answer your question, Melissa? Joy.
Well, do you think that the
United What's that again, Joy?
Do you think that the United States should change her policy in Formosa since the people there have shown hostility to the United States?
In Formosa, are you speaking? Yes. No, I wouldn't say that we ought to change our fundamental policy. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean that the policy of mutual security, of common defense. But let me be very candid with you. I think the time is at hand for our government to re-examine our overseas missions. My personal view is these missions are too large. There's a tendency on the part of Americans to want to sort of get into an American colony. And if I were living overseas, I can understand how I'd feel about that. Americans are accustomed to better living standards. And this promotes, after a while, a resentment. This is really a very touchy subject. So let me say this. I'm going to introduce a resolution into the Congress asking that our Foreign Relations Committee and the Armed Services Committee re-examine our entire overseas personnel commitments. I'm of the opinion that they're too large. Now, I'm not sure, but I'm of the opinion they're too large, and as such, they have a tendency to promote hostility.
Yes, Judy.
In this re-examination, sir, do you feel that there will be a cut made?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, the other day in the hearings on the Mutual Security Act, I brought this topic up with Secretary of Defense, Mr. Wilson. And in his usual candor, and by the way, he's a very candid and an interesting gentleman, Mr. Wilson said that they were contemplating a 12% cut of our overseas military personnel. Now, that's in our, what we call our overseas military missions. This does not necessarily mean in our troops, but in those that are there for training and purposes of development of overseas military power.
Yes, Judy.
Will there also be a cut in the civilian manpower?
I imagine
there?
So. I think so. As you know, we try to hire as many of the native peoples as we can. But you see, what I think Americans fail to understand is that those of us who are paid very poorly, even when our wages are low, live much better than the vast majority of the people in other areas. And while for a time they may be grateful for our presence, after a while there's a little growing resentment. Now, this isn't being anti-American. It's just that, well, you just can't take it that long, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Doug.
Senator Humphrey, in light of this expanding trade into Red China, would you personally, under present conditions, support the recognition of the Red Chinese government?
I don't think that's the issue at all, but I do think that the issue is that we ought to re-examine our trade policies and possibly our political policies with China.
Do you think we should recognize Red China?
No, I don't. I don't think so until China has made amends at the United Nations. She's still branded as an aggressor before the United Nations, and I think recognition of Red China at this time would have a very serious effect upon our relationships in South and Southeast Asia. By the way, how would you feel about that? I've talked to a number of young people about it, And I don't think anybody ought to be closed-minded.
Doug, I think we have 450 country, or non-existent country, with 450 million people. And I think it's time that the Americans should wake up and recognize Red China, because we're going to have to be doing business with them, and we don't have we're not in a bargaining position now.
Well, may I ask you, would you recognize her before the United Nations took some action on the charge of aggression that Red China still has leveled against her in the UN? Don't you think we ought to go to the United Nations and see whether or not the Red Chinese are willing to make some amends in terms of their...
No, I don't think we can get the Red Chinese to bargain until we recognize them. And I don't think they'll make amends till we can get to the bargain. That's why I think we should recognize them.
I think you ought to come testify sometime. Thank you. And I'm not closed-minded about this. I want you to know.
Uh-huh. Robert Crosman.
What influence does the powerful nationalist Chinese lobby have on the non-recognition of Red China in Washington today, sir?
I really don't know. I'm not trying to duck the question. I wish I did have an answer to it. They never worked on me, if you want to. I'll be very frank with you. I have never been what I called a pro-Chinese nationalist as such emotionally. I've just felt that it was desirable for us to keep Formosa from falling into the hands of the Red Chinese, and primarily because there are many million of what we call overseas Chinese that would have no political home to look to if the nationalist government in Formosa were to fall, or if that area were to go into the hands of Red China. And I'm speaking of the Chinese in Indonesia, in Thailand, in Malaya, even in India and other areas. Now, those are merchants. They're very prominent people, professional people. They're skilled people. And if they were to defect, so to speak, all into the hands of the government in Peking, I think it would have an injurious effect upon our overall foreign policy.
Let's go up to Tom Roberts. Tom.
Sir, at the present time, we are having a disarmament conference in London.
Yes.
Now, do you believe that if Russia accepts our Western proposals, that there are any guarantees that she will follow them?
Well, let's make this quite clear, because that's a good question not only for me and for you, but for the whole American public. The truth is, any agreement that we come to with the Soviet Union must never be relied upon on the basis of good faith. If you're going to look upon the good faith and honor as a means of enforcement of any agreement, then really you're just dreaming. You're smoking political opium, so to speak. Now, any agreement we come to with the Soviet will be lived up to simply because the Soviet finds it's necessary to do so, to her advantage. And there are some things that may be to her advantage and to ours. For example, the economic burden of constant armament on the Soviet Union, with the tremendous cost of this new equipment, is really causing the Soviet Union, I'm sure, very serious troubles. Her people are becoming restive. They want consumer goods. Now, therefore, do not rely upon treaties, alliances, honor, and good faith to keep the Soviet Union in line. Rely upon self-enforcement, inspection, mutual benefits, the need of getting something done. And I want to emphasize inspection, aerial inspection, ground inspection, political inspection, as foolproof as we can make it.
Do you think they'll go for that, Senator?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I think there's a possibility. Let me say this, and I want to say, if the Soviet Union does go for any kind of disarmament program at all, it represents a fundamental change in Soviet political policy. Mm-hmm. It's a possibility. I don't want to go way out on the limb. I've been chairman of this disarmament committee, and by the way, next week we're releasing a very, what I think, important report on the Soviet Union and the possibilities of disarmament negotiations with the Soviet. I think it'll be out released in the middle of the week.
You wouldn't give us some idea what that might say, Senator?
Well, I don't think...
ask you this. Is it favorable so that you think we can get together with them? There can be a settling of this great problem.
It depends upon how much the desire is on both sides. I think there are real factors today that are compelling the Soviet to talk for the first time realistically about disarmament. Now, if we're not too sticky, too inflexible, we might be able to make a beginning. And may I caution you, a little teeny bit of a beginning. There isn't going to be any great big overall disarmament. If you can get an Arctic zone, for example, if you can get a 10% cut on arms, if you could have a modicum of aerial inspection, it'd be good. Well, let's take one of these others.
All right, Phil's waving his arm.
After you get this small start, what would be the second step then, sir?
I don't know. I've never been very much of a prophet. I find out that in these matters, if you can look ahead 24 hours, you're pretty lucky, and you're almost brilliant and a genius. I'd only say this, that the important thing, as in all other things, is a start, because the start represents a change of fundamental philosophy, and that's particularly true with the Soviet.
Yes, Phil.
I'd like to go back to this thing in London. Mike Mansfield has stressed a big four meeting.
Yes.
I'd like to know, I know that you do not go along with it.
Oh, Well, now, wait a minute.
At least
I think you don't.
Wouldn't
you rather have it after the London talks?
I said so. In fact,
yes,
I do go along with it. I'm an admirer of Senator Mansfield. I think he's he's one of the truly great men of the United States Senate, and he is unusually well qualified in the field of foreign policy. And his proposal is sensible. My only suggestion was that as long as these talks are going on in London of the United Nations Disarmament Subcommittee, where Mr. Stassen is, that we ought not to have any summit conference before those preliminary negotiations had taken place. It's a matter of timing. And then the summit conference, which I'm all for, so that we can climax it, seal it, and really put the stamp of state approval upon it. That
is heads
of state.
Why do you think Mr. Mansfield wanted it right now, though, before the London talks?
Well, I don't know whether he stressed that point quite so much. No, I don't believe... Maybe I don't quite understand it like you do.
Doug.
Well, sir, you were talking about this disarmament report. Exactly what is in it? Could you give us the idea?
Exactly. I can't give it to you. You're a good reporter. What do you think my 12-man committee would think if I got on this program and revealed what was in that report a week ahead of time? They'd fire me, and I got enough trouble already.
Well, we'd promote him, Senator. Yeah, Henry, you're waving your hand up there.
Don't you think it would be a good start toward... better conditions in the world if the United States were to take the first step to stop hydrogen bomb tests?
I feel that the limitation of testing on hydrogen weapons is an absolute essential. I really do, and I hope that our government will proceed with it. Now, I said limitation. I don't mean unilateral. I don't think that we should do this alone. This is another one of those negotiable points, and I'm of the opinion that the Soviet Union is keenly interested in it. And let me tell you one of the reasons that I think the Soviet is talking disarmament. They are very fearful that other countries are going to get hydrogen and atomic weapons. They may be even fearful that Red China is going to get one. And when you look at the map and see the common frontier between China and the Soviet Union, it is entirely possible that the Soviet may not have all the confidence in the long-term good relationships with Red China that she has for the moment. After all, the Chinese have been parading into Central Europe a great deal lately, trying to sort of be the big man of communism. They went into Poland, they've been into Hungary, they've been into Romania and Bulgaria, when Khrushchev and his boys have had to stay home. I don't think the Soviet Union's too happy about this.
Sally.
Sir, Senator Noland has proposed an escape clause to this Atoms for Peace organization. Isn't this sort of indicating to other nations that we're going in kind of half-heartedly and looking for an out if things don't go our way?
I think so. May I say that I'm going to support the president's proposal on the Atoms for Peace program. I think the treaty that has been developed is about as good as you can get. None of these treaties are foolproof. There is no way in the world that the Americans can have a foolproof, absolutely sure, secure existence. And we are, in a sense, the people that take gambles. We pioneered a whole continent. We are free thinkers in many ways. We are ingenious. We like to have new things in science. Let's not be so fearful. After all, we're the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. What are we always worried so much about? As a matter of fact, the other people have a good reason sometimes to worry about us in view of our wealth, our strength, and our prestige.
Let's go to Maliz.
Well, in taking gambles, couldn't you possibly say that atomic weapons, just by the simple horror of them, might prevent war? I mean, that they could be a preventative as well as a starter?
Yes, I think so. I think this is part of our defense philosophy today, the deterrent effect of the massive hydrogen weapon. And I'm of the opinion, as I said earlier, if I didn't say it, I intended to, that another reason that the Soviet is willing to talk a little bit more realistically in London and disarmament is because Mr. Zhukov, General Zhukov, was the head of a task force in the Soviet Union that examined into the entire military potentialities of the H-bomb. Mm-hmm. And apparently that report shocked not only the military, but the political leaders of the Soviet. And since then, they've been just a little bit more careful what they've been saying. The H-bomb is a terrifying weapon. And I'll add this. Those people in Russia that are running the country today, they like to live. They're living pretty well. They're not anxious to have their factories blown to bits. And the Soviet leaders today have always sacrificed the philosophy or the ideology of communism to the immediate needs of the Soviet Union. Yes.
Joy.
Well, you recently said that you'd like to have all jet displays stopped to the public.
I didn't hear that yet.
Oh.
You recently said that you want a jet display stopped to the public.
Oh, yes.
Jet airplanes.
Do you think
not all jet air displays, but go ahead.
Well, do you think that the public wants these stopped?
Well... What I said was that I thought these ceremonial flights in low altitude and close formations should be banned over metropolitan areas, and I still say so. After all, the American people don't need to go into that kind of activity too often. If we want to have a jet formation, let them fly at 20,000 feet or 15,000 feet. You can see them pretty well. And they go fast enough so that you don't get too good a look even when they're high. Let's not put them over crowded urban areas as they did out in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We've had some trouble out there.
I know.
And tragic trouble.
Tragedy, Senator. Indeed.
Young Bob Brown.
Senator, do you feel that we could eliminate aid to West Germany since they have more or less regained their economic stability? Do you feel that that we could sort of reduce their aid to just possibly military aid? And
well, that's about all it is right now. Yes, I think so, very definitely. West Germany today is one of what I would call the have nations, not a have-not nation. Phenomenal recovery. And there should not be any continuation of economic aid, military, yes.
Young man you've seen on the floor.
Yes, indeed. I'm delighted to see him here.
Billy?
Too. He's a fine young man.
Billy?
Senator Humphrey, this civil rights bill that will be before the Senate pretty soon has sections in it which, as written, would permit the government to get injunctions against civil rights violators, mm-hmm. or people that violate this. Mm-hmm. And this more or less just denies a trial by jury. Are you in favor of this?
Well, this, of course, you never deny a trial by jury in a criminal case, but in civil suit, this is not unusual. Also, a case in equity, when it comes to cases of law in equity, the failure to use trial by jury is quite common. Furthermore, when it comes to contempt, of course, court cases, very seldom do you have trial by jury. Yes, I'm for a right to vote law. I'm for a right to vote law that means something that is effective. And may I just add this, that the judges that will be making these decisions are judges from the local area. There'll be judges, northern judges in the north, eastern judges in the east, southern judges in the south. They know the temperament of the people. They know the culture, the background. And I happen to believe that our judicial system has done more in recent years to protect the Bill of Rights and to protect the meaning of our democratic institutions than any single branch of our government.
Well, Senator, doesn't our judicial system as it stands state that there should be trial by jury for such things as this? In many cases?
It states that there should be trial by jury, of course, in any criminal case, but in civil cases, not always. In contempt of court cases, insofar as I know, seldom. In cases in equity, which is what this amounts to, because a man's rights are being denied, and you really need protection before the right is denied, then it is it's customary to have a decision by the judge rather than jury.
Yes, Judy.
I'd like to get back to the Red China question for a moment. You stated before that Russia was fearing Red China, fearing their acquiring...
Possibly
fearing their acquiring a hydrogen bomb. Wouldn't we be helping to split Red China and Russia then if we gave aid, rather, if we released our trade barriers to Red China?
That's again, as I happen to say, and I said here over the weekend, that I thought we ought to re-examine this entire trade question vis-a-vis our allies and ourselves as it relates to Red China and our own self in relationship to Red China. I don't think you should have closed minds on these things. Now, these are explosive topics politically, but I think a man in Congress and the President and the Secretary of State, all of us, have to look at what is the long-term good of the country. And if we see that it is possible to split two major communist powers, or to, if not split them, at least to draw them further apart, then we ought to proceed.
Yes, Judy.
And on the question of not recognizing Red China while she's still an aggressor, doesn't Colonel Nasser in Egypt say the same thing about Israel? They refuse to recognize it because it's an aggressor. Do you feel that this is right?
Well, I don't think that Israel's been an aggressor in that sense.
Yes,
I think that Israel, in a sense, what she tried to do, as Ben-Gurion told me when I was visiting with him, he said he saw the buildup of arms in Egypt. And he went in like the sheriff in the old pioneer days of the West. He just went in and disarmed the rowdy or the bandit, and it took the weapons away. By the way, I saw those weapons on display. They were Russian weapons. They're mighty good equipment, but they're all in the hands of the Israelis today. They really made a clean sweep. They took all the chips off the board, I guess.
But unlike...
I'm going to come back to you, Judy. I want to go over to Bob Crosman right now.
Senator... Senator Wayne Morris, for whom I know that you have a considerable regard, has compared President Eisenhower's official actions as comparable to those of Dave Becks. Do you go along with him in that?
Well, I think Senator Morris put in the record the other day his speech, the transcript of his speech, and I must say that the interpretation that was placed on that speech earlier did not jibe with what the senator had to say. What Senator Morris has been saying is that an administration that gave the Idaho Power Company, now as it is revealed, now $83 million in tax benefits, is performing an immoral act. Now, first of all, he said this when he thought they only got $17 million. In the meantime, the Kefauver for Anti-Monopoly Subcommittee has revealed, under testimony from the Federal Power Commission, that the Office of Defense Management, without any recommendation from the Federal Power Commission, gave the Idaho Power Company not only the rights out in Hell's Canyon, the rights which I think belong to the people, that is, the right to build dams on a river that belongs to the people, not to the Idaho Power Company. The administration not only gave them that right to build the dam, but they gave them a fast tax write-off provision that saved them $83 million and cost the taxpayers of the United States some $80 million, according to the testimony. Now, if that's all true, I'll only say this, that the administration will have to stand accountable before the American people for what I call outrageous favoritism.
And will President Eisenhower have to stand accountable?
Well, President Eisenhower is the head of the government. I mean, I've never presumed that we had some sort of collective leadership,
No. And
I've never presumed that that the president didn't represent the country. Of course he's responsible. Now, he may not have made the decision himself personally, but having not made the decision personally, he can remove anyone that did make the decision personally. And I would most respectfully suggest to our president, for whom I have a high regard, I would suggest that he examine into this. And if somebody did give this kind of a tax favoritism, tax write-off, at the expense of the American taxpayer and the American people, the man ought to be fired summarily, quickly. And what is more, the Idaho Power Company ought to have their right to develop that river taken away from them.
You feel that there was some criminal
behavior
involved?
I'm not a judge. I don't charge anybody with anything like that at all. I have been for the public development of Hell's Canyon.
Let me go over to Senator DeSalle. Sally, thanks.
Sir, back to Russia for a moment. You seem to feel, in just listening to you talk, that Russia is relaxing her rather strict policies. And yet, I wonder, sir, a Russian very high official just recently stated that succeeding generations of America will be ruled by communism. Does this indicate to you that they're relaxing their objectives of ultimate world communism?
I couldn't thank you more if I were to express thanks for that question, because let me tell you, the Russians aren't relaxing a thing in terms of their objectives, that is the Soviet. The Soviet intends to communize this world. Now, they may have come to the conclusion that they're not going to blow the world to bits with H-bombs, but mark my words, they'd like to pick up the world bit by bit. And any little bit we let them pick up, they're going to take a hold of. They have sticky fingers for world real estate. Make no mistake about it. They're very gregarious and acquisitive people. Now, I don't happen to believe that the Soviet communists or any communist group is going to take over this world if we try to stop it. And when I say stop it, not just be anti-communist, but let's be pro-freedom. For example, if there never were a communist in the world, people ought to be taught to read and write. We ought to fight against illiteracy, against poverty, against disease, against oppression. We ought not to have a Marx or a Lenin or a Stalin or a Khrushchev to motivate us. We ought to do this because we love people, because we believe in democracy. And what I ask you young people to do is to become on fire with, literally consumed with, the love of democratic institutions. And this means a belief in the dignity of people, a belief in their equality. It means a belief in the fact that there is a fatherhood in God. It means a belief that there is a need for freedom of conscience. Believe this. Don't take it for granted. And then be willing to go on out and carry the message. That's all I'm saying. And they won't take over anything. I want to compete with these Soviets. I say if they want peaceful competition, I'm willing to take them on any place, anywhere, on their terms. Economically, culturally, educationally, politically, economically, militarily, psychologically, anything they want, if that's what they want to do. If they don't want to drop bombs, if all they want to do is have a conflict of ideas, let's go to the mat. I hope you feel that way.
That's quite a bit. Yes, Gail Oliver.
Senator, if you want to stop all this illiteracy and everything, why don't you start at home? You have all this foreign aid and everything, and I think that you should try to begin at home. You know, charity does begin in the home. Well, you give everything to all the other countries, and then you don't stop to appraise everything that's going on here. Why don't you do that?
My dear young lady, we're not giving anybody anything. What we're doing is for ourselves. You cannot have America living in a world slum. Just think that over for a minute. Two-thirds of the people of the world are sick, illiterate, diseased, and feeling a sense of hopelessness. Now, America cannot exist in that kind of a world for long without becoming a garrison state. So what we're doing when we help other people, when we share with our food, share with our technology, our science, our teachers, is to help ourselves by helping them. Now you say, why don't we help ourselves? We are. Mm-hmm. Now there's much more to do. I realize that. And I've always been one that believed that we should use the institutions of government and our private institutions to expand opportunities for people. I believe in civil rights for all people, in civil liberties. I believe in education, and I believe in it strongly. I believe we need more and better schools, and I believe we can afford them. And I'm not one of these people that thinks that freedom is free. You got to pay for these things. But let me just add to you that Americans have no conception how well they are off compared to the rest of the world. I've seen people in slums and filth and degradation that broke my heart and made my body ill, literally, within the last month. I never thought that could ever be so. And I came home, and all I could say is, what a privilege to be an American. What a privilege, and yet what a responsibility. It's a tremendous responsibility today to be an American.
Yes, Doug.
Well, sir, could the fact that you're so fond of Eisenhower and have endorsed him on many things be attributed to the overwhelming majority the Minnesota electorate gave to him in the last presidential election?
I got many more votes. I got many more votes than that, and I wouldn't even brag about that. No, I didn't say I was fond of Eisenhower. He's my president, and he's your president. I don't believe in being personal about
it.
Oh, no, I said I had a high regard for Mr. Eisenhower.
Same thing.
Oh, but that doesn't mean his policies. I disagree with his tight money policy. I disagree with his high interest rate policy.
How about his advocacy for peace?
I've disagreed with his farm policy. I've disagreed with the manner in which their fiscal policy is conducted. And I like to argue politics not on the basis of personalities. After all, we have to live with one another here. And when politics gets personal in a democracy, then it starts to fracture and split up. Let's talk issues. On Adams for Peace, I'm for it. I believe in supporting the president when he's right, and I have. And believe me, when he's wrong, I believe in standing up and being counted too, because I'm an elected public official. And you see, it isn't a matter here of whether you're friendly or not. It's a matter of how you believe and what your convictions are.
Well, Doug, I know you've got many more questions than all of you have, but Senator, we need another half hour for just the political side.
This is wonderful. These young folks are wonderful. Can I just add one word?
You know, quick one, please.
I want to add this. Let's use American food as an instrument of American foreign policy abroad. Let's not restrict our farm population at home in order to cripple ourselves abroad. I saw the good that this food can do with CARE and all the other programs.
I must interrupt. I'm sorry, Senator, our time is up.
Had to get that plug in.
You did well, indeed. Thank you very much, Senator Hubert Humphrey, for being with us today as our guest on Youth Wants to Know. And now this is Steve McCormick speaking for Theodore Granick and bidding you goodbye.
The questions you have just heard do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Youth Wants to Know, the National Broadcasting Company, or the National Education Association. For reprints of today's discussion on Youth Wants to Know, send 10 cents to Ramsdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington, 18, D.C. Join us again next week at this time when NBC will present The American Forum. This is Ray Quinn speaking.